supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Last spring, the Obama administration told school districts they should allow transgender students to use the bathroom of their choice. Now, the Trump administration has rescinded that guidance in a move charged with symbolism. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron looks into what that actually means for local school districts.
Let's start with Philadelphia. The state's largest school district recently passed a sweeping policy that allows transgender students to use the bathroom that corresponds with their gender identity and to be addressed by the gender pronoun they prefer. That policy still stands and will continue to stand, says Superintendent William Height.
We're proud of that policy and glad that we can provide what we think are very safe and supportive environments for all children.
Across Pennsylvania's 500 school districts, roughly 20 have policies similar to Philadelphia, says Emily Leader. She's a lawyer with the Pennsylvania School Boards Association. One Pennsylvania school district mandates students use the bathroom that aligns with their biological gender. That district is facing a lawsuit, and there's a similar case before the U.S. Supreme Court.
The law is unsettled. We don't know which way it will end up. And between the Supreme Court case and the Pennsylvania case, we should have more clarity about what to tell our members the law says in the next few months.
By rescinding the Obama-era guidelines, the Trump administration may help tip the balance in those pending cases, but until the courts rule, school districts can stick with what they were doing. Yesterday's decision is, however, a psychological setback for transgender advocates like Deja Lynn Alvarez of the LGBTQ Home for Hope. It may also be a rallying cry.
We may not gain any more ground in these next few years, but we can fight as hard as we can to make sure we don't lose any ground.
Alvarez and others say they're happy to be in Philadelphia, where transgender students do have specific protections. But those protections are still a matter of vigorous debate, in the courtroom and out. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron, WHYY News.
If you're planning to visit Philadelphia's criminal courthouse, count on having your phone locked up. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports that the city has announced a new policy. Most court visitors will have to place their phones in a locked pouch before entering a courtroom.
Right now, most judges don't allow cell phone use in courtrooms, but people do it anyway. In some cases, photos have been taken of undercover cops and witnesses and spread around to intimidate them. Joseph Evers with Philadelphia's court system says starting this spring, sheriff's deputies will place phones in a magnetically locked pouch, which people will carry with them. When they leave court, the pouch will be unlocked.
Phones, as you well know, you can put them on silent. You can stick them in your pocket and record someone and not even touch the phone. This prevents that from happening.
But Philadelphia civil rights attorney Paul Hetznecker says the new pouch policy is a solution in search of a problem.
It's not as if there's been a slew of cases where people have taken photographs and been charged with trying to intimidate witnesses on the stand. That just hasn't happened.
Hetznecker says forcing people to place their cell phones in a tamper-proof pouch is an overcorrection.
But to deprive everyone that comes to the courthouse, which is a public building, it's a public forum, the right to communicate with family members or witnesses or others, I think is really an overkill.
These pouches, made by a San Francisco company called Yonder, have been used increasingly at live shows and concerts to cut down on the number of cell phone videos that are leaked. Court Administrator Evers got the idea when he had to slip his phone into one of them before seeing comedian David Chappelle stand up in Valley Forge. He then ordered 4,500 of them for Philadelphia's court system. He says locking up a phone will work better than the campaigns that have tried to stop people from texting while driving.
Maybe actually watching a court proceeding and not texting will get you more interested in what's going on.
While the new rules intended to make police and witnesses feel safer, to people waiting hours for their cases to come up, it's a nuisance. Take Cheryl Tyler, who was recently watching a case involving a family member. She would rather her phone not be in a pouch the whole time while she's sitting in court.
No, I want my phone in no pouch.
What if an emergency happens? And there's another issue.
Because my pouch might get mixed up with somebody else's pouch, and then they gone off with my phone, and I might not never get it back.
Officials are crossing their fingers that the pouch mix-up rate will be low. All the pouches look exactly the same, but the hope is that people will hold on to them tight. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Under President Donald Trump, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security plans to add 10,000 immigration officers. It's also broadening who is a priority for deportation. Now, while those changes will take a while to roll out, WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports that hundreds in Philadelphia are already training to disrupt deportations.
In the cavernous basement of St. Thomas Aquinas Community Center in South Philly, a mock immigration raid is underway.
No, you can't take her! You can't take her!
It's part of a training by a nonprofit advocacy group called the New Sanctuary Movement. The group hopes to leverage a loophole in immigration enforcement that federal agents generally won't make arrests in houses of worship. The idea is to create a kind of mobile sanctuary wherever a raid is happening through prayer and song.
This is the light of God. I'm gonna let it shine.
Here's how it works. When immigration agents approach a home, people inside or neighbors are instructed to call a hotline. That initiates a text alert to all of the trained volunteers. For this exercise, about 150 of those volunteers are going through the motions of responding to an alert. They're split into three groups, one playing family inside the house, one raid disruptors, and one law enforcement.
You are not allowed to pass. Please stand back.
This is a law enforcement operation. Stay 5 feet back.
It's intense, and a lot of volunteers say they feel anxious afterwards. So far, 1,300 people have signed up and 500 have trained. Executive Director of the New Sanctuary Movement, Peter Pedamonte, says the goal of showing up during removals is three-pronged.
There's a couple of goals. So yes, it is to be in solidarity and show up for families. Two, it is to shine a light. And then for some people who are going to risk arrest, it is to peacefully and prayerfully disrupt.
That means circling an immigration vehicle or a home to try to stop removals, which is risky. Disruptors could face criminal charges for impeding an arrest. Training attendees were about one-third immigrants or refugees and two-thirds a mix of other Philadelphians. Language tutor Emily Grablitz says hearing stories about deportations moved her to come.
Yeah, I think the targeting communities is something that just, like, makes me really angry. It's like they purposely want to break up any sense of, like, safety or stability.
Over the last 3 weeks, the New Sanctuary Movement has confirmed 6 instances of immigration enforcement in the region. Activists and immigration attorneys say, while it's a small spike, it's not the same kind of coordinated activity seen in other cities over the last few weeks. Local and national immigration officials have said recent enforcement was routine and targeted. Even without big numbers in Philadelphia, uncertainty about what future enforcement will look like under President Donald Trump has been breeding fear. Hector Portillo is from Honduras and says he's at the training to support his neighbors in South Philadelphia's Indonesian community, many of whom are in the country illegally. But he's not sure if he'll show up for a raid.
I know I like it, you know, help people, you know, support it. But I scared get arrested, you know, I lose whatever I got.
He's scared he could lose his green card. A few days after the training, a call to New Sanctuary's Pedamonte shows his group is still working out the kinks, like getting people to call in raids in a timely manner.
Two were after the fact and one was during. And what we're really pushing for is for people to have this number saved on their phone.
A few minutes later, he gets another call. People are calling the hotline to report any police activity or if they have miscellaneous immigration questions tying up the line. So far, the group has been called on once, but it wasn't a disruption. Without an address, the group ended up protesting outside Immigration and Customs Enforcement's headquarters in Philadelphia. Cities from Kansas City to Austin, Texas, are developing their own immigration response networks. For grassroots responses like these to happen, a lot of people have to be on board to call in raids and to respond to them. In Philadelphia, there's at least one high-profile champion. Mayor Jim Kenney has been plugging the hotline. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benshoff.
The importance of historic preservation in Philadelphia will be taken up Tuesday as part of a continuing Praxis Dialogues focus on the contentious topic. Among the panelists convening that evening at Philadelphia's History Museum will be Wendell Pritchett, Presidential Professor of Law and Education at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Professor, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Happy to be here.
And let's note that the event is co-presented by Plan Philly and that you serve on WHYY's board of directors.
Correct.
Your interest is both academic and quite personal, having grown up in Society Hill. Take us back to 1967.
Yeah, so in 1967, my family bought a house at 5th and Pine, we had moved from North Philadelphia, and we then, in 1970, 3 years later, moved from 5th and Pine to 2nd and Locust. In that case, we were actually recruited by the developer of the property, because being African Americans and the Fair Housing Act just having been passed, the developer realized that it would be a good idea for him to have recruited somebody of color because it was a federally supported project. So we were the only black family on the block, and it was a wonderful experience. My parents still live there, and there's no question that growing up in both a historic area and an urban renewal project shaped my life.
Though certainly in the intervening decades, as property values around Society Hill have escalated, it's led to, if anything, less diversity over time.
That's exactly right. So, you know, as we get to the conversation about historic preservation, which I think is very important, I do think that these issues are interconnected. And that we do need to be careful in all of urban redevelopment projects that we make sure that we can promote diversity in its all its forms.
You know, when one tries to, on a ledger, determine the value of historic preservation, terms like spiritual, aesthetics, beauty, how can that be quantified, though, on a balance page?
So they are difficult. They are difficult values to be quantified, and we are a society that likes to quantify things. But I would point out that democracy is also a value that's hard to quantify, yet we still find it important. So just because we cannot quantify it does not mean it is not important. And I do think that we can reach some agreement about some baseline of issues that we have, we all think are important. So, for example, I think we all agree, or almost all of us agree, that Independence Hall is an important resource that we should maintain. The more difficult areas are, you know, with properties that we don't have that common agreement on. But, you know, the value of democracy is we debate these things and we make decisions.
Though we are living at least the present in what seems to be increasingly partisan and contentious times, are you optimistic that that kind of accord can be found?
Yeah, and the reason why I'm optimistic is so that the discord, I think, is mostly at the national, sometimes at the state level. But in local communities like Philadelphia and other places, we do have common values. We do have common interests. There are reasons why people choose to live here, stay here, move here. It's certainly one of the values that we have as the city where the country was founded. Is preservation of important institutions and buildings that help us, you know, remember our history. So, yeah, we'll disagree, but I think we have a lot of agreement.
Though, to the extent that cities, and specifically Philadelphia, would then otherwise be called on to shoulder the burden on their own, how can they make their way without federal and or state aid?
This is a large problem, and of course, the city of Philadelphia, which is stretched to the limit in lots of ways in terms of our budget, in terms of serving the needs of the people. Yeah, this is a difficult thing. Right now, as you know, there still is a federal program for historic preservation, and there still is limited funding in several pots to support preservation of particularly important buildings. But yeah, at the state and federal level, the city of Philadelphia needs support to do these things.
You served as Deputy Chief of Staff and Director of Policy for then-Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter. Does the current administration share many of the Nutter administration values regarding historic preservation?
I think so. I think that there are many commonalities. I think there are the continuing tensions that we've already been talking about. It, you know, preservation is important, but how do we pay for it? How do we balance the need for preservation with the need for economic growth, for change? We are fortunate in this city that we're actually experiencing a population increase, and we need to house the people. And so there are tensions, certainly, about this, but I think that there are more similarities than differences between the two administrations.
Professor, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Pleasure to be here.
Wendell Pritchett, Presidential Professor of Law and Education at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Mm-hmm. A new survey by the American Psychological Association suggests people are more politically stressed in 2017 than they were last summer. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Ann Hoffman reports that prior to then, overall stress levels were declining.
The American Psychological Association has been polling people about stress for the past 10 years. They survey around 3,000 people meant to accurately represent the United States. In August, they included questions about politics and the election.
Because the results were so striking related to stress and the election, we actually went out for the first time again and polled in January.
That's Dr. Lynn Bufka, who works at the association. They found that between August and January, average stress levels rose in a statistically significant way. More than half of participants said the current political climate is a very or somewhat significant source of stress. 59% of Republicans said the future of the nation was a significant source of stress for them. 72% of Democrats said the outcome of the election was stressful. Bufka says it's possible that people tend to be less stressed in August than in January, but some therapists locally say they are seeing it.
I would say at least half of my sessions each week, you know, there are concerns that patients are bringing about the political situation or fears that they have specifically about themselves or friends or loved ones and how things that are going on are going to impact them quite directly.
That's Dr. Tamar Chansky, who practices in Plymouth Meeting. She says she's never experienced this level of political worry before in patients. Thea Gallagher, a psychologist at the Center for the Treatment and Study of Anxiety at Penn, says her patients cite looming uncertainty about the future.
And so I think for a lot of people, it's about how to manage that stress with tolerating the unknown, because still they have to go live their lives or be productive in their day-to-day life in the present.
Her job, she says, is to help people stay in the moment and not get too caught up in anxiety. She says that for people who don't feel any political anxiety, now is an opportunity to have deeper conversations with others. More meaningful dialogue across the political aisle couldn't hurt either, she says. Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
Love the spring-like temperatures? Well, so do birds and bees and flowers and trees. Let's head out of doors with Mike McGrath, host of You Bet Your Garden, Saturday mornings at 7 and again at noon on WHYY. Mike, it's springtime.
In February.
Is that a good thing?
No, it really isn't, Dave. I mean, I am as guilty as anybody else. This past weekend when we had those just insanely warm temperatures, my wife and I were out on our balcony getting sun on the back of our necks, and it was glorious. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about last year, which was the warmest winter in recorded history. And what happened at the end of that winter is, as you can probably remember, you certainly remember if you're a gardener with flowering trees, at the very end of that winter, we had a hammering cold front come down from the Arctic, drop the temperature in the burbs down into the teens and the 20s, and it didn't qualify as a, quote, late frost. We had been inside the realm of you are still at great risk of frost, and it was still going to be great risk of frost for another couple of weeks. The problem was the plants were following the temperature. They were blooming weeks early. And so entire peach crops, entire apple crops, ornamental flowering trees like flowering cherries, once the flowers freeze, it's over.
What happens in turn to bees and other insects that are part of the process as well?
That's a really good question, because if those flowers die on one of the first couple of days, you know, we tend to think of it in the other direction. Oh, the bees will come in and they will help us have more magnificent fruits. But what happens from the bee side is, hey, when did this diner close? Nobody told me. So where they would have a couple of weeks of nectar and pollen from these huge plants that are very important to their survival, and there's not a lot else in bloom at that time of the year.
For the cohort of home gardeners, yourself included, you don't want to just sit still. What can be done?
hopefully you have trees that are manageable, dwarf-sized trees or semi-dwarf trees. If you have a standard apple tree, for instance, that thing's going to be 30 feet tall. You're limited in what you can do. But if you have a manageable tree that you've kept pruned that's like 6 or 8 feet tall, one of the best things you can do is cover it with Remay. Now, that's a brand name, but it's what people talk about when they talk about a floating row cover. If you look at these, you've seen these pictures of the lettuce fields in California where there's blankets over the crops. Well, those are a polyethylene or polypropylene woven material, sometimes cotton woven material, and they sit on top of the plants, and the frost collects on top of the row cover and doesn't affect the flowers as much. And if the row cover goes on earlier in the day, it can trap some heat. But actually, what I do with a peach tree that's right outside our front door is the Goyesha Christmas light trick. I still have all the old Christmas lights from my parents' house, the old C7s, C9s, the little incandescent lights that get really hot. You get a couple strings of these old incandescent Christmas lights, which you can still find at yard sales and in people's attics. String them around the branches as much as you can. And then as soon as the temperature starts to drop down, you turn them on, and you don't care about time of day or anything like that. You leave the lights on. That has proven to be 100% effective.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, Dave, my pleasure.
Mike McGrath, host of You Bet Your Garden, Saturday mornings at 7 and again at noon on WHYY.
Oh, sunshine.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.